you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to Strong Female Characters, a podcast where every week we assemble like a feminist Voltron to celebrate the badass woman in geek culture through unfiltered deep dives into the nerdverse. I'm Cher.
I'm Preeti.
And I'm Courtney.
And I don't know if you guys all know this, but something big happened this weekend.
What was it?
The Oscars.
What?
Yeah.
I've never heard of them.
But you know what? I did not watch the whole entire show or any of it. I just watched clips online the next day and like Twitter.
I watched it. I got tricked into it.
I watched bits and pieces. I was mostly watching Doctor Who.
Yeah, I was mostly watching Pitbulls and Parolees with my dogs.
I watched the whole thing.
Everyone.
Yeah. I got real confused. It was a very confusing. It was a confusing production.
That's what I've heard. Also, I think it's interesting that the ratings were the lowest ever, which I kind of think has more to do with the nominees and the lack of diversity than like a lack of hosts, because they didn't have a host last year. I don't think not having a host is a problem.
I just wonder if it's people are just kind of over it. Like, I think that it is like a matter of like the you know, it's very much, you know, that if Ford versus Ferrari comes out, it's going to be nominated for an Oscar, whether anyone cares about it but your dad or not.
Right.
And do people care? I think that's why Parasite, which we will get to, obviously, was such a big deal for people, where it's like, wow, a movie we actually care about won things. That's wild.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think it has to go to the fact that I think the way the nominees, like when they announce the nominees, I think that gives a good gauge of how. And I'm talking out of my ass. I have nothing to prove this. But I think lately that kind of dictates how dialed in or how tuned in people are going to be to the award ceremony, because it's just like, it's bullshit at this point. And then there were moments during the show, which, you know, again, I know enough to have a conversation about it, but there were moments during the show that it felt like very like performative woke, like performative diversity, like, yay, like people of color, yay, women. And it was like so ham-fisted, but it's like, cool, you didn't fucking nominate the majority of these people. I don't know. But yay, Parasite. And Taika. Yay, Taika. Sorry.
Usually I find the Oscars to be a huge disappointment. For example, this year they nominated ScarJo not once, but twice. Which means she had more nominations than the single person of color nominated across all the acting awards, which was Cynthia. Oh my God, what's her last name?
Erbo.
And it was all but in the bag for, honestly, the truly sublime 1917 to take the best picture. But then Taika Waititi, as we said, and Bong Joon-ho won the best screenplay awards. Then Parasite won again and again and again. Taika is the first indigenous person to ever be nominated in the screenwriting category, and he is the second person of Maori descent to ever win an Oscar, period. Parasite is the first non-English film to ever win Best Picture, and Bong Joon-ho is the first person to win four Oscars in one night since Walt freaking Disney. Now, this doesn't mean that the Oscars are fixed just because some people of color won, but it is a happy moment when a film like Parasite can be celebrated and appreciated by the same organization that gave Green Book an award for Best Picture. It feels like inviting all those marginalized people to join the Academy actually did some good. Who knew?
As Preeti said, our boy Taika made history as the first indigenous person ever to win in a screenplay category, and he's believed to be the second Maori winner after sound engineer Hammond Peak, who won for Return of the King and King Kong. Fewer than 10 indigenous people have ever been nominated for Oscars, let alone one. Taika's win was historic, and he took his moment to honor indigenous children, saying, "I dedicate this to all the indigenous kids in the world who want to do art and dance and write stories." We are the original storytellers, and we can make it here as well. He also acknowledged the land on which the Oscars was being celebrated. The Academy would like to acknowledge that tonight we have gathered on the ancestral lands of the Tongva, the Tataviam, and the Chumash. We acknowledge them as the first peoples of this land on which the motion pictures community lives and works. Obviously, this is of importance to Taika, as it should be to everyone, but that goes ignored unless it's the twist of a horror movie.
Yeah, I love that he called that out in his speech, that he specifically made note of the land that they were celebrating a mostly white award show on. I don't know why I'm whispering that, because it's not a big secret that that show is very, very white.
Well, and that's obviously, like, that's a thing he does. He did on the opening shooting day of Ragnarok. He had a land acknowledgement ceremony, and it was presided over by a Maori officiant, and he had the Bundjalung tribal dancers from that right. community in Australia dance there. Like, that's a really big, important thing, and it should be to everyone. Like, that's like, we're literally on the land that we robbed from people.
Exactly. I mean, and he's, with every single project that he's done, he's very, very big on celebrating Maori culture and celebrating indigenous cultures. He infuses them into everything, because even in Thor Ragnarok, for example, there's some of the costume design that's done in that movie is based on or kind of paying homage to Maori, like, historical outfits that they would have worn, like different mm-hmm. tribes and stuff.
One thing that was annoying is that there were some people who immediately made it as though Greta Gerwig was snubbed in favor of Taika, which, like, could we not? Like, the Academy snubbed Greta in ways of, like, not nominating her for Best Director, right. things like that. But don't make it seem like, oh, this
indigenous
deeply
man
privileged
winning.
Man.
The fuck out of here.
IndieWire literally titled their piece "Academy Snubs Greta Gerwig for Best Adapted Screenplay" and compared the two films, which took some reach. They are very different.
They are
movies.
So different. And listen, like, I've never seen Little Women. I've never seen any Little Women adaptation. I've never read the book. I don't have any type of, like, nostalgic or sentimental attachment to that movie or that property. I have seen Jojo Rabbit, and Jojo Rabbit is unlike any movie I've ever seen in my life. It's like Mel Brooks level. Like, think of the absolute best Mel Brooks satire. Like, it's just such a high level of satire. And doing satire is incredibly difficult. And this was just such a creative, different thing. It's like, listen, I'm not shitting on Little Women. I'm not saying that Greta Gerwig did not deserve any nominations. But it's been done already once before. Like, this was more original to me. I don't know. I haven't seen, again, haven't seen the movie. I'm sure it's great.
I loved both of them. But, like, art is subjective. And right. that's just, it is what it is. But the thing that really annoyed me in the IndieWire piece is there's a literal, like, end blurb that says, "The post has been updated to reflect the historical significance," sick, "of Waititi's Oscar win." It's like, so clearly this was just like, oh, he beat Greta and then, like, got shit on. So it's just like, but it's also good that he won. The end. I don't have time to spell significance right. Goodbye.
There was just a lot of, like, very uncomfortable, I mean, honestly, like, racism that jumped out after the Oscars. And you saw it not only in the, like, sheer white feminism of the Greta Gerwig was snubbed for Taika Waititi, but also in the anger that a subtitled film won Best Picture. You know, there was a lot leading up to it. Like, I genuinely was like, 1917 is going to win because of all of the articles that came out about being annoyed at having to read a subtitled film.
Plus, the Academy notoriously is horny for epic war movies.
Yes, so. For all of those reasons as well. And there's still, like, there was, like, a Mother Jones piece that came out yesterday that literally was, like, this person being like, "I hate subtitles. They're stupid." I think there was a line in it that was, like, the only people who still do subtitled films are countries that are too poor to afford dubbed film.
What?
And it was like, whoa, you're really going to publish that? Like, this is about the, like, assumption that a film that is not in English is less than. Like, the best thing that's come out of all of the Parasite, like, press stuff is Bong Joon-ho recognizing the absurdity of, like, American egocentric film awards. Like, this idea that English films are better that, you know, white films are better, that whatever, and him being like, yeah, it's a local ceremony, and then like sweeping is the best thing that's ever happened.
First of all, everything about him is great. And did you see, is it, what's her name? Jenny Yang? Yan? What's her name that does
Yang.
Okay.
Yang.
I always get her and Jenny. There's three different Jennies. I get their last names confused because I always forget who I'm talking about. Did you see her tweet, her story about how when she was shooting the sequel?
Oh, Jenny Han.
Jenny
oh,
Han. Yes, that's
about,
it.
You're talking about Jenny Han.
Because Jenny Yang is a comedian. And Jenny Han, that's...
Yes.
Okay. So Jenny Han, she was tweeting a story about how they were shooting the sequel to All the Boys I Loved Before, and they were in Korea, in South Korea. And they had a PA as their driver because you kind of have to like drive everywhere when you're in Seoul. And she starts talking about Parasite. And the driver's like, oh, like, is he famous over there? Like asking about, you know, Bong, if he's like famous or not. And she's like, oh, my God, like he's the most famous, like he's the biggest Korean director, the most famous Korean director, da da da. He's like, oh. And then she starts asking him about like his parents. And his last name was Bong also, which is like, listen, it's a common last name. It's a common name, you know. So she's like, he's like, oh, yeah. He's like, yeah, my father also has, you know, he works in the film, like works in film. She's like, oh, like, do I know any of his work? And then he starts listing Bong movies. And she was like, oh, my God, like it's his son was her PA. And was like so unassuming, did not. Like make a thing out of the fact that his dad is who he is, you know. But it was a very funny, very cute little anecdote, and I personally have loved seeing Bong on the award circuit. Like I loved seeing him when he won the Oscars and he was like making them make out like Barbies. Like everything about it's like he sees. I felt like he's such a breath of fresh air because he sees everything for what it is. And is kind of like, this is madness and ridiculous, but I'm going to enjoy this ride while I'm on it because this is a wild ride. And mm-hmm. like, but I feel like that's kind of, I like seeing that because too often I think you hear or see how Hollywood and that in the industry deforms people in a way. Like the little girl that's in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood that's 10 and was posing and talking during the red carpet like she is 33 and like an adult, and that always kind of creeps me out when children act like adults, because it's like, be a kid, like get to be a kid, you know, like don't know how to give face on a red carpet at 10.
I love that story ended with the driver being Bong Joon-ho's son, because Bong Joon-ho has such powerful dad energy, like just like taking pictures of his cast winning. He's just so proud. It just makes me so happy.
So good.
There were other moments of note in the night. Joaquin's speech was a real roller coaster.
Yeah.
A lot happening there. A lot going on. You know, we praised him for his speech last week. It got away from him.
And I think this is a prime example of why he needs to write shit down.
It's one of those things that I would not tweet.
I would not say it out loud. Like, I wouldn't do anything. I didn't watch the whole thing because I heard how cringeworthy it was. And what's that term when you get like secondhand embarrassment? Like, I was like, oh, this is terrible.
It was very uncomfortable to watch. Like, I watched it with my sister and we were both like, you almost got there. And then you went took a real hard turn. And it got away. It just got away from you.
Didn't he like equate eating?
That's the thing I was about
animals.
To say. And I thought you were telling me not to say it.
Oh, no, you can say it. No, I'm not saying don't say it.
Yeah, no, I was going to say I'm uncomfortable. I wasn't going to tweet it because I did not want like animal rights people like, you know, getting very mad at me on Twitter. I'm really uncomfortable with equating putting milk in your coffee to being on the same level as like racism in the industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or just racism.
Uncomfortable.
It was very uncomfortable.
Like, you can't equate choosing to not be vegan to systematic oppression of an entire race.
Yeah.
Or anyone that's not white.
Yeah.
I do want to point out very quickly, like, we touched on sort of the performativeness of having so many people of color on stage, which I agree. There's this like really uncomfortable notion where you have like Janelle Monáe and Billy Porter doing this incredible intro, but then having her say like, you know, I'm here representing this thing that is not being
right.
recognized for its greatness. Mm-hmm. And same with like Utkarsh Ambedkar came out and rapped a recap in the middle of the show, which I was super excited about because I love him and he's like great South Asian rep. And he said a line like, I'm here to do a recap about nominees that don't look like me.
Yeah.
And so it was like this consistent recognition. But mm-hmm. the Oscars were produced by two women, a white woman and a black woman. So I do think that there was a specific like, fine, we didn't do the work in the nomination process, but we're going to try to do some course correcting. And it was just like a really like weird line to, because I don't know what's worse, right? Like
yeah.
not having that
yeah.
or having it. Like right. I don't.
And I don't think producing that show is the same as voting on nominees.
Right. No, not at all.
So but it's I think people definitely need to understand the difference there. I think on behalf of the Oscars as a whole, I can understand the two people producing the show. They're like, well, here's our chance to
exactly.
give people a platform. And good on anyone. I'm all for anyone that uses their privilege and their platform, whether it's, you know, again, race, gender, you know, socioeconomic, sexual identity, whatever your privilege or platform is. Like, when you have the chance to have a platform and you have people, a captive audience, people are listening to you, I'm all for people taking that moment and shooting their shot and making a statement to elevate others. But it does feel on the flip a little like, okay, well, the Academy as a whole, because they obviously are going to sign off on whatever the show is, you know, like it's not like they get to just do whatever they feel like it. It just feels like, okay, well, you're okay with benefiting from the entertainment of people of color, of women of color, you know, of the LGBT community, of women, but, you know, and having like, you know, the moment when Gal and Brie and Sigourney presented together and they were all like, yeah, women, like women are superheroes. It's like, you shouldn't have to fucking have them say that, you know, like you should just be giving those movies the same love and attention or giving those properties or projects the same love and attention that you would if it was predominantly white cast and director.
It's just always cringy when the audience is like laughing on, like, ha, there's no black people nominated. Like,
yeah,
guys, that's
mm-hmm.
that's for the home audience joke.
But one joke that I did think was great, again, did not see the whole broadcast, saw a clip of this, watched it multiple times because I laughed my ass off, was when Rebel Wilson and James, what's his face?
James Corden.
Thank you.
James Corden.
Came out in Bad Cats costumes and then did the whole bit and started smacking the shit out of the microphone. The microphone part was so funny to me. I think that whole thing was so funny because think about it. Like, they were dressed up and then agreed to have full, like, pancake makeup done and wear those costumes on stage. Like, that's being willing to play.
They didn't even have to do that for the movie.
They didn't even have to do it. And I think, right, exactly. And it's like,
they were just like kind of I don't know. I was like, you guys are assholes. If I was Tom Hooper, I'd be like, fuck you guys.
I thought it was funny.
The VFX, one of the VFX artists, Eves McCray, said, he tweeted this saying, hey guys, I haven't watched all of the Oscars, but I assume these two were really classy and thanked me for working 80 hours a week right up until I was laid off and the studio closed, right?
Ouch. And that's the thing, like, I don't think they were making fun of the VFX. I think they were kind of taking the piss out of the general consensus about the movie. Side note, it was by Universal. They do sign me a paycheck.
Yeah, I don't think you were on the one where I said, like, I don't want to get fired, but this movie was buck wild.
Yeah. It's like, I didn't see this movie. Please don't fire me. But I thought it was funny because clearly there was at one point in time when Cats was first announced that they thought this was going to be an awards contender.
They literally released it unfinished so that it would be released.
Yeah, in time to be considered for the Oscars. And clearly that was not the reaction that they got. And I thought the part to me that was funny, like, I didn't take it that they were making fun of the VFX people that worked on that movie. I took it as like they were kind of like the best way, like if you have a bomb in Hollywood, is to kind of like be in on it. Kind of how like Sandra Bullock showed up to accept like a Razzie when she was nominated the same year that she like got nominated for an Oscar. Like I think that letting yourself be in on the joke is just kind of a better way to be about things instead of just pretending it didn't happen or getting like all in your feelings about it. But the cat, it was the cat smacking the mic stand that made me lose my shit. That's what I thought was so funny, because they were literally like their eye line. They were watching it like they were really cats. And it was very, that part was funny to me, whether or not they even had the outfits on, but the outfits made it better.
Well, we got more to say though. We got more to say, and we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the other big event that happened this weekend. Yes. A little movie called Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn.
Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn opened this weekend to $33 million. Frankly, not a terrible opening, but as with female-fronted films, this is, of course, a disappointment that must be examined. According to the Male Brain Trust of Twitter, it's due to the film's unsexiness, meaning it was not filmed, costumed, and entirely designed around the male gaze, as Harley was in a little film that rhymes with Shmooicide Schmoth. In an effort to boost sales, major theater chains are changing the title to Harley Quinn, Birds of Prey. Which, like, fine. Non-comics fans aren't super familiar with Birds of Prey. It's why Guardians of the Galaxy was a surprise hit. It shouldn't be the expectation, particularly when female-fronted films are always going to face more bullshit. Plus, it was rated R, and it made its budget back internationally. Not all female superhero films exist in the same realm for the same audience. Honestly, a fairer comparison might be John Wick 2, the second entry for a character in an R-rated movie that is pretty violent and also earned around $30 million. It's
actually
opening
no. There is a perfect comparison for this, and it's not John Wick. Batman fucking Begins made $48 million in its opening weekend, just like this movie did. That's it. Period. End of story. Batman Begins underperformed. Superman Returns, which was the Superman that, you know, that asshole Bryan Singer did, but Brandon Routh's Superman, made more money than Batman Begins and did not get a sequel. So Batman Begins got a sequel off of the same exact opening that this movie had. It got a whole trilogy. People are still horny for this trilogy to this day. So I don't want to hear it.
But, you know, when women are at the center, people want failure. Anything less than a massive success is failure.
Right. Which
and
is bullshit.
That's dark. It is bullshit. And but, like, we want to, honestly, numbers aside, because you can skew the numbers in any way you want, and you can talk about the numbers in any way you want. Like, I think there's a very weird, deliberate, insidious narrative that is being pushed about this movie.
Yeah.
That it's a huge failure. But the fact is that this movie is actually super fun, super great,
so good.
Super authentic. So like, let's talk about that side of it, that like, regardless of what the media narrative is around the success or failure of this movie, one, go see it, please. It's
yeah, definitely
awesome.
Go see it. I never gave a shit about Harley Quinn. I was always like, whatever. She's there. This movie made me like Harley Quinn, which is weird because she's a fucked up character, but this movie actually made me like Harley Quinn. I think this presented her in a much more three-dimensional way and gave her, she was an actually flushed out character, and I can't say that there's ever been that for this character in any other iteration. Plus it's got a fucking awesome soundtrack, hello, and all the clothes look like if you raided David Bowie's wardrobe during like his Ziggy Stardust years.
This movie was clearly like what happens when you give strong cast of women to a female director and a female writer, because it was so there. You know, you watch these movies and you see it like I saw Suicide Squad, and I thought my biggest issue with that movie was honestly like the loss of potential. Like, there was so much potential in that movie to be great, and they just didn't trust the audience. But the two best parts of that movie are Will Smith and Margot Robbie.
Yeah.
Because Margot Robbie, despite the way her character is treated, like, she treated the role with aplomb and really felt like she understood that Harley was an important character. And so getting to take that character, who Margot Robbie clearly loved, and put it in a role where she is respected by the director and the writer. Like, you could tell the difference.
Yeah. And see, overall, I think the other thing, too, is that you have multiple female characters in this movie that they're not likable on the surface. Right. They're not likable.
And they don't have to be.
Exactly. And they don't have to be, yet you end up completely rooting for them. And they are all damaged. And they all are... They're all, it's female vengeance. And I think that really at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what you call this movie, it's because it's female vengeance. And I think that studios have a hard time marketing that because they're still trying to market it to the typical audience, which is like the white male audience. And I think also that audience, it makes them uncomfortable because there were definitely moments in this movie where I could relate to various parts and various emotions and various reactions that each of these characters had. Obviously, there was a slightly more extreme level, but like you knew what it was like to feel like the woman that is just like the token woman and you never getting your opportunity to really stand and be a leader or be taken seriously. Like Black Canary felt, right? Like she's just the girl. She's just the broad. She's the pretty girl, you know, and she's never getting the recognition or being able to actually take center stage or really fucking run shit. And she's capable. Or,
I mean, that's also like Rosie Perez's story with Renee Montoya in the precinct. I thought this movie, like, I agree with you. I thought it was super authentic, super relatable. You know, there are moments in there that are, you know, when you're watching as a female viewer, like, mean something, right?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like, I keep comparing it to when I saw Avengers for the first time. Like, seeing Avengers in theater was such a good time. It, like, didn't have the baggage of the entire MCU. It had, like, it was just, like, a kind of, like, banana story, like, really fun action sequences, like really fun camaraderie between the cast. That's how I felt watching Birds of Prey. Like, it was a fun ass movie to see in the theater where you're just like, this is like, I had a smile on my face almost the entire time because it was just watching these people, like this ensemble cast, like have a good time with each other in these like absurdist scenes.
Yeah. You know, I'll be totally honest. The first time I saw Avengers, I was like, eh. And then after I started caring more about the other characters, I went back and rewatched Avengers and then I liked it better. And I think this again goes back to the, like, giving these other movies, listen, Avengers made a shit ton of money, but that's because it was like, they put that out well after they established the MCU. And
I
think comparing the MCU to the DCEU is not really fair because those are two very different tactics. So I'm going to compare it more to like the Batman movies. And Batman Begins, I was like, it's fine. But then after I saw The Dark Knight, I went back and I appreciated, like, in its entirety as part of the sequel and the overall story, those movies work better together. Obviously, there's going to be people that feel like one is stronger than the others, but Batman Begins was fine. It was a fine movie, you know?
I very much meant like the experience of seeing a movie in the theater, just like the sheer entertainment value of it. Like, I'm meaning that, like, I don't think movies, like superhero movies, need to have this like intense depth to them.
Right.
Like, I think Birds of Prey was a great example of a movie that, like, if you are from a particular community, you might get more out of it. But I think every single person who goes and sees that movie, like, will enjoy it if they take it at face value.
Yeah.
Like, if they don't, like, tie a bunch of, like, expectations and hopes to it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, it's just a fun movie. Like,
totally
that's
is.
What it was, right? Like, it's just going into it. It's, like, bright colors. It also, like, made me feel like a lot of, like, when I watched Scott Pilgrim.
Yes. It like, had that
it's
very...
just this, like,
like, it felt like it was pulling you into a comic book a little bit.
Yeah, it was very, like,
zaniness.
Stylized.
Yes.
Very, like, you know, it opens with a cartoon of Harley giving us her, like, background. It's got, like,
Which
Harley's
so
voiceover.
Funny. I loved her voiceover in this whole movie.
So funny. Like, it was a very funny, like, I think, smart movie. Like, I, not to say it's perfect. Like, I think narrative, like the narrative structure had its weak points, you know, like I didn't think the whole, like, going back in time and rewinding and like nonlinear storytelling was necessary or, yeah, or really worked all that well, but it didn't matter at the end of the day.
It wasn't, like, at the end of the, yeah, day, it was fun. It didn't not work, but it didn't elevate the story.
Right. It wasn't, yeah, necessary. It was, that felt very like stylistically driven, not narratively, yes, driven. And you could kind of tell.
Yeah.
Right. But that said, like when you watch this movie, like you can see distinct differences in Kathy Yan's direction and recognizing that these women are women. Because, okay, so there's this scene like when Ewan McGregor, who is a delight, like, yes, a goddamn delight in this movie, who is like kind of funny and like this villain that you're like not necessarily taking seriously, but then he's in the club and he's like feeling, oh, like very, God, like,
yes,
small.
Yes.
And he forced this woman. And it was honestly one of the most, like, the hardest,
wait, spoiler,
to watch. Sorry, spoiler alert. I mean, we're like in it now. So, yeah, spoilers throughout, like, sorry. But he, you know, he's like forcing her to undress in front of this room full of people. He like forces her, and it's so uncomfortable. But I, yeah, think the difference in the way, like, he has a man to like rip her dress off, like whatever. But the difference in the way that it felt very much like this was not centering, like we were not meant to be voyeurs in this situation. We, yeah, were meant to identify with how anxious this woman was. Like, they, right, didn't tear the dress off. So it wasn't like we're like this like lewd moment of watching this woman's like dress
actually
turn off.
It wasn't hypersexualized. That's really
exactly.
What it, yeah.
It was uncomfortable. It was anxiety inducing, but it was about her pain and anxiety, not about the kind of like titillation of seeing a woman's dress torn off.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was like, that's a line, right? That's the difference that you get when you have someone who understands that experience.
Absolutely.
Filming the experience.
Yeah. And you can say that really kind of across the board with so many, yeah, things in this movie, because I, yeah, know that Harley, for example, she was wearing just as little as she was in any of, yep, the previous movies, and yet it never felt like she was being hypersexualized or it was like objectifying her in any way, because, mm-hmm, yeah, she was wearing this just as little, but everything about how that character was claiming ownership of herself, of her behavior, of her actions, and of like knowing who she was and deciding like, yeah, this is who I am. And this is like how I'm going to use my sexuality the way I choose to use it.
Right.
Whereas before, it always felt like she was Joker's arm candy that was, mm-hmm, dressed that way for him.
There's a great, like people are doing comp scenes of how, literally how, like, Margot Robbie moves in the two roles.
Yeah.
If you look at how Harley moves in Suicide Squad versus how she moves in Birds of Prey, like, you can physically see the difference in,
oh, yeah,
the character who is owned and the character who owns herself.
Right.
Like, doing similar things, like dancing on the pole. There are shots of Harley in both films dancing on the pole, and they are drastically,
yeah,
different
moments.
Yeah,
because one of them is supposed to, like, one, she's supposed to be titillating to Joker and whoever else is there.
Yep.
The other one, it's a little bit of like, a fuck you, I'm getting up,
yeah,
and I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to be drunk. I'm getting, like, it was so defiant. Even in Suicide Squad, okay, which I did not see all of Suicide Squad because it was hard for me to sit through that movie. But I do remember when you first meet her in Suicide Squad and she's in the cage and she's doing like this sexual like Cirque du Soleil, mm-hmm, dance, and then flip to this movie in Birds of Prey, where she's doing a lot of the similar moves, but she's beating the shit out of guys, you know?
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And I, all for that. Like, listen, I am a very sex positive feminist. Like, I used to work at Hooters. Like, I know. So it's like, I get the whole like thing about objectification versus like, if you're stupid enough to pay me money or give me attention because I have like this shirt on, then like, I'm going to fucking take advantage of that, you know, whatever. sorry, not sorry, you know, whatever. But I did not have any expectation for this movie, and I ended up thoroughly enjoying this movie. And Alana Bennett, I saw, tweeted a great description. She said that this is like Dayglow John Wick, and it totally,
yes,
is. And I mean, John Wick, yes, obviously is Keanu, but still, I love those movies. I loved this movie, and I'm just really disappointed in the coverage there has been around this movie. And I'm wondering if there was also something in the way these movies are being marketed and promoted.
Oh, no, I think there absolutely is. Like, there needs to, it's sort of like you see a lot of one size fits all.
Yeah.
Marketing when it comes to these superhero movies, but when marketing is at its best is when it's specific to the property.
Yeah.
And I don't know that. I don't actually know. I'm assuming there's some kind of firm that's doing all of the promotion and marketing for this. Like, I don't know if it's internal. I don't know if it's external. But whoever is doing it, I think, you know, there was a great article a few years ago that I believe, I want to say it was on like Radar or something, that was about John Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And why that film tanked wasn't necessarily like the film itself. It was how the film was talked about and how they decided to market it, because that matters so intensely.
It absolutely does. And when people go like, oh, it's R rated. That's why. Dude, Deadpool blew up and that had an R rating. So it's like, and that was, I think, a great example of a movie that did fantastic marketing and like it marketed itself for the movie that it was. And I just, I don't know that that's what happened with this movie. And I feel like, you know, to be honest, I don't know that that happened with the previous Wonder Woman movie. And I don't know that that's going to happen with the next Wonder Woman movie. Like, I just, there's a commonality there, you know, because it's like, I'm not saying it's just, you know, unique to DC. Like, I don't really know how we're going to see Black Widow marketed, because we've only seen a couple trailers, you know?
I mean, that's like a very, I feel like Black Widow is a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
It's
but I just mean
lot,
like female superhero movies overall, because even if you go back to Catwoman, listen, I know.
Or like Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters. Like, I just think there's something with the way that female movies are not being marketed properly. And again, I think it's because, and I understand, you know, when people, like, their jobs are like, we have to get numbers and we have to make sure we hit a certain box office. And that's someone's very real job. And, you know, sometimes when they're like, yeah, but they can't afford to take this certain risk or do this certain thing because they don't want to alienate the audience that usually shows up for them. And I understand that, like, someone's job truly is on the line when it comes to this stuff. But at the same time, it shouldn't be someone's job is on the line. Like, someone should be like, hey, they're still making all this money. How are we going to get all these people that we're not catering to? You had three women of color that were lead characters in this. Okay. And there's been numerous reports over the past couple of years how Hispanic or Latino audiences are the biggest growing demographic in the movie industry that are showing up to movie theaters. And you have Rosie Perez, who is an established household, iconic woman that is in this movie.
That's a bigger that's also a bigger conversation, because I will say this, is that like those studies came out. They've been coming out every year for like almost a decade.
Yep.
And there is a intense, like, very clear commitment to the power structure that exists in Hollywood, like a very clear, like, messaging structure that exists of like we every year it's the same conversation. So like that I'm not surprised by this notion that like the fact that Fast and the Furious like makes $1 zillion every single movie that comes out because of people of color, because of people of color going to the theater to spending money to go see these movies in the theater. So like, that is not at all surprising to me. With Birds of Prey, I agree with you. I think misogyny is a lot of it that comes into it, and not, like you said, catering the messaging to audiences, to the potential audience, but catering a message to an audience that has been proven to be diminishing. Less so about the specific person who was doing that job, and more so about the like kind of
the
general
corporation. Yeah.
Right. This general like storyline and narrative within Hollywood and what deserves the focus and attention and what doesn't. And so with Birds of Prey, I think all of us, what we can do is kind of like reiterate that like you should go see this movie in the theater, which we recognize as an expensive prospect. But like, if you're gonna see a movie in the theater, like this is one to go see.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like it's such a joy. Like I want to spend a little time on the visuals.
Yeah.
Because like the sequence where Harley comes to the precinct.
The police, yes, with the fun gun.
The freaking fun gun and the glitter and
awesome.
The color.
I want a fun gun and I don't like guns. And I'm like, oh my God, if someone sent me a fun gun that shot glitter and like, oh my God, I would lose my shit. There would be glitter all over 30 Rock. Literally, like every single day, I would get in trouble because there would be glitter everywhere over 30 Rock. If someone like, why doesn't that thing exist? Like, come on, there is an opportunity there and you missed it. Who doesn't want to be just throwing glitter everywhere? I love it. I also like, and I don't know that this was intentional, but I also love how gay that is, because you know how usually the gay community, the LGBT community, when someone is homophobic, they glitter bomb them. And I just, I would be glittering everything.
I appreciated the explicit queerness of this film.
So like, queer.
Putting Rosie Perez as an ex-girlfriend to Ali Wong and having it said on screen, I thought was great. And I know that Margot Robbie has come out and said that she wants, like, in the next film, for Poison Ivy. But again, why you should go see this in the theater is, like, I want, like, a million Birds of Prey movies.
Oh, hell yeah. And also, in the animation in the beginning, when she's talking about all her failed relationships, one of them she shows is with a girl. So I was like, right off the bat, like, you're like, hey, we are embracing everything that this is. And I love that. I love that.
I mean, there's so much to love about this movie from, you know, like we said, like all of the women, like you have all these women. So you can have so many like LJ Basco, who plays Cassandra Cain, mm-hmm. who is, by the way, Dante Basco's niece. Rufio.
I didn't know that. Oh my God, that's amazing. She is Hollywood royalty. Recognize.
Like having this little Asian girl who is in such like, and having, again, spoilers, having this little Asian girl, this little 13-year-old girl who is like
a total punk ass.
Where they're fighting all the men of Gotham.
Yes.
As Roman says. And at each moment, one of the women check in with her to make sure that she's going to be okay. Right.
Yes. Like, I love that. Great. Yeah.
But then giving her the role of blowing Roman the fuck up, literally, was one of the moments of genius in this script.
It really was. Because I didn't see that coming at all. I thought that like Bruce was going to show up, which, by the way, I think it's hilarious. She named her Hyena after Bruce Wayne.
Brucey.
So funny. But I also really appreciated there was this tenderness, like you said, like with all the women checking in with her. But I think it also showed the reality of like, this is going to sound kind of corny, but at the end of the day, like these women were all looking for love in some manner, whether it was from other women, it was from friendships and camaraderie. You know, Harley even saying at one point that, like, you know, she hates to admit it, but she liked having the kid around because it was, she had someone that just enjoyed the things that she did and just wanted to be with her. It wasn't trying to make her be evil or anything. You're just literally kicking back, watching cartoons, eating cereal, and you like the same shit. And it's like, I think that it was so awesome to see that because, again, even though these characters, some of them are very fucking flawed human beings, which everyone is, you found the humanity in each one of them, which I don't always think happens when you're talking about this genre.
No, I agree. I thought they did a really, really strong job with everyone from Journey Smollett Bell, like we talked about Black Canary. I did also want to talk about Mary Elizabeth Winstead as Huntress because I thought she was so funny.
Yes.
The moment where she's like this whole frustration and anger that no one will call her what she wants to be called. Like the crossbow killer. No.
And practicing how to say they call me Huntress. And then they're like, that's a really badass name. Like it is a badass name. You're absolutely right.
I wish I could remember who said this, but somebody on Twitter was like, Birds of Prey is the like equivalent of two drunk girls in the bathroom together.
1,000%
complimenting
yes.
each other.
Yes, it is. It so fucking is. It so
there
is.
There's like a specific camaraderie that comes from being in the bathroom at 2 a.m. with a bunch of women at like some bar or some club.
And especially after if you find out one of them just got fucked over by her boyfriend, which like
you're
I think we should.
Thing.
Yes.
Hold up. Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We really should talk about what's at the heart of this movie, which at the end of the day, this is a post-breakup movie. And it's obviously told from the perspective of a girl that just had her heart broken, even if it was by a trash guy. Because regardless of who you love, if there's one thing that truly unifies everyone, it's that simple fact that most of us at some point has been in a relationship, at least one relationship that was truly on every level completely fucking bad for us. We've all had that one thing, if it was a fucked up fling, unrequited love, a long-term mind fuck, or emotional roller coaster that nearly broke us and hopefully in some cases gave us the strength to make it out the other side stronger and more self-assured than ever before. And Birds of Prey is that story. It's that ultimate post-breakup story, and Harley and Joker are definitely one of the most toxic love affairs in comics history. But Mr. J and his one-time paramour are hardly the only problematic pairing. The genre space is rife with them, and comic books are ground zero. So we're going to take a look at a couple of the most iconic couples in comics and break down the good, the bad, and every moment she should have dumped his or her ass and moved on. So we each picked a couple. Obviously, you know, we did tease a little bit about Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy, which it is going to be in the next season of the cartoon, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And Margot does want it in the next movie, and hopefully there will be a next movie. But I think we should save that conversation for another date, because I want to compare some of the other couples in comics that are like really known. So obviously, Preethi, you could start it off. And I'm sure everyone's going to be very, very shocked at who Preethi's going to talk about.
Gasp!
This is so off-brand for you.
So obviously, like, I picked Peter Parker because romance is a big piece of Spider-Man's history. He has these like iconic loves. You know, there's an entire miniseries called Spider-Man Blue that kind of goes through his history with Gwen Stacy and Mary Jane, and tries to right some of the wrongs a little bit. You know, if you go back and read classic Spider-Man, one of the things that kind of jumps out from the text is consistent casual misogyny. Just all the time. It makes it tough to go back and read those issues when you are just constantly seeing the way that women are belittled in the narrative, and the way that like Peter thinks so little of like Betty Brant and the way he talks about MJ. Because, you know, the way MJ and Gwen Stacy were set up were as like diametric opposites. Like Gwen Stacy, Peter knew from school. He knew her like through this, and MJ's kind of this like wild party girl. You know, you've got the blonde, you've got the redhead, you have these things. And of course, we all know the infamous like Gwen Stacy, who existed to give Peter motivation. Goblin killing Gwen Stacy is one of the most iconic moments of fridging in entertainment history, arguably. So
it's just at this moment that I realized Peter's early love stories were very Archie, Betty, Veronica.
Oh, 100%. It's every women in early, I think you see a lot of this of female characters in early comics tend to be archetypal. Like they don't get to be fully fleshed out characters. They don't get to be anything other than like representative of pieces of what a man might want. It is difficult to engage with. And there are some rights that have been attempted to be, or there are some wrongs that have been attempted to be righted by taking these legacy characters and giving them agency now in the last like two or three decades.
I picked Catwoman and Batman because this couple, they basically, since Catwoman's introduction, and she was known as the Cat back then, they are just the epitome of like passion and two people being drawn to each other that they probably shouldn't be. Because it's, I mean, it's like a pure physical, like you just really want this person. Because literally every single timeline, pretty much, that Batman and Catwoman, because, you know, DC with their alternate universes, almost every alternate universe, those two end up with each other. And even when it's not Batman and Catwoman and it's Selina and Bruce and they don't know that the other one is who they are, they're still drawn to each other. So that is like pure magnetism with the two of them. There's pure sexual chemistry there. They're very sexual pairing. They're also so fucking dysfunctional because all they do is fight. Like every single incarnation of that romance is those two. It's like you want to fuck them and fight them. That's really what that relationship kind of always is.
I mean, okay, so here's what I have a question for you, because yeah. I'm not a huge DC reader. Like, I enjoy the cartoons, I've seen the movies.
Yeah.
But to me, like my Catwoman and Batman are very much from the movie. You know, it's very much like Michelle Pfeiffer.
Right.
And so to me, what that relationship has always been kind of more on equal footing, which I've found very refreshing, in that like it doesn't feel like either one of them ever truly has power over the other.
Exactly. Yeah. 100%. And it's really, I think, it's a constant push-pull with the two of them. Like, there isn't somebody that's dominating that relationship, because at one point, just when it seems like everything's going to be working out for them or whatever the case may be, one of them gets the other one, so to speak. I would say maybe even in some cases, Selina might slightly have the edge over Bruce, because he just, like, he's always drawn back to her. And I think that the interesting thing about both of them is that I think, similar to how Joker and Batman have this very antagonistic yet symbiotic relationship with each other as a villain and a hero, because they represent so much of each other. Like, you know, Batman, if he just went slightly further across the line, like he's basically Joker. Joker's his id, right?
Right.
I think there's something similar in some way when it comes to Catwoman and Batman, because I think she's a murderer. She is, you know, very cunning. She's all these dark things, and she wears her darkness on the forefront a little bit more openly. And I think that that part of her is a part of him. It's like that's the suppressed darkness in him that he's trying so hard to always not cross that line. She crosses it. And I think that's what he's drawn to. And I think the fact that he's able to not cross that line, I think Selina deep down wants to be able to not give into, or not. You know, I think like she doesn't have any impulse control. He does. And that's what she's drawn to in him, that he's able to control his impulses a little bit better than she is. Because there's times where Selina, people like to say she's a supervillain. I think she's more of an anti-hero. And I think a perfect example, like, of this is really in the Christopher Nolan movies, in the last one, in The Dark Knight Rises, when you see that he's like, I know there's still something good in there. You are going to make the right choice. You are a good person. And I think that she really, as a character, wants not only to believe that have someone believe that about her, but she wants to believe that about herself. And I think that's what she gets in Bruce, is that when he has those moments where he's affirming that she is good, she believes it, and she's actually able to be good to him. But then it's like almost like out of like she comes from a very damaged past, you know, where Bruce witnessed his parents being murdered, which obviously is his huge damage. Her huge psychological damage is that it was either her father or her stepfather abused her. And it's like they're never able to really get over those things. And that forms so much of who they are and how they operate. So it's like I think that that's always a thing that kind of pulls her back from allowing herself to really be with him. And also because she's Catwoman, you know?
I mean, it's funny because I'm comparing it in my head a little bit to Black Cat and Spider-Man, because Felicia Hardy is not a dissimilar character from Selina Kyle, in that she's sort of an anti-hero. You know, she runs good and bad. And they're like the Spider-Man-Black Cat relationship is one of my favorites, because it is painfully uneven, where Felicia kind of has all of the power,
right,
and Peter has very little. Not to say that he can't hurt her, because, like, you know, there's a whole superior Spider-Man arc that forces, you know, whatever. Like, I've whatever. But there is this notion of, I think the most interesting aspect of Black Cat and Batman is that equality, is that kind of like evenness of footing between the two of them, because it's so rare in our like classic comics couples. I think another one that you can kind of see it in is Rogue and Gambit.
Mm-hmm. And even though they were never totally a couple, like I think maybe they are sometimes, I kind of feel that way about Wolverine and Jean Grey.
Yeah, I mean, Jean Grey has all this other, I mean, this is the other thing about female characters in comics is the baggage that they are given yes. by their writers. Like, Jean Grey is a really unique proposition to me because of the way her character is treated outside of her relationships and yeah. that, you know, with the Phoenix and Madeline Pryor existing and all these like kind of strange things. I think there could have been the potential for Wolverine and Jean Grey to have a similar thing, but because of her backstory, it can never truly be equal, because like you look at these kind of classic relationships, because like Cyclops and Jean Grey is like a huge mess.
Yeah, yeah.
And
like, I hate them as a couple too.
Right. And even like Lois and Clark with like Superman and Lois and Clark, like I'm not up to date on the comics, but classic iterations, it's supremely uneven. Or like even Steve Trevor and Diana in the comics, right? Like supreme, even though she's the superhero.
Yeah.
Still supremely uneven in terms of their footing within the relationship. So like, I feel like Batman and Catwoman are sort of the ideal in comics in terms of a relationship that is with two people who have a more even idea of power, and possibly because of what you were talking about earlier with the shared idea of trauma. Like, they both have the shared trauma because it is comics, and so we are faced with seeing dysfunctional characters who have to kind of commit to dysfunctional relationships for drama, which is interesting. Because, like, I mean, when you think of ideal relationships, to me, it's like Coach and Tammy Taylor in Friday Night Lights. Where it's
to me, it's like Leslie and Ben. That's like ideal. Right, like
It's the notion that you don't have to have relationship strife for drama or story's sake, but I don't know that comics is necessarily
comics
there.
Are just animated soap operas with superheroes.
Right.
That's really what they are. They are soap operas, but there are superheroes in them.
Exactly.
Because everything that happens is fucking batshit, literally, when it comes to Batman and Catwoman.
But I do think we're getting to the point where you have characters like Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy, which we're not getting deep into, but Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy in the comics, by all accounts, have a far more functional relationship. And because you have more people writing, more people with varied perspectives writing to give us a more evenly paced, like, notion of what relationships can look like in comics, which is really nice.
Yeah. I mean, I hope we do get a sequel to Birds of Prey and that we do get to see those characters on the big screen together. But for me, you know, Batman and Catwoman, they are definitely the sexiest. Again, because it's like there's that raw passion, that magnetism that they're drawn to each other. And it's also kind of heartbreaking because it's like they're, you know, the only time we really get to see them, as far as we know, have a happily ever after was in the last Batman, the Christopher Nolan movie. Where it's like they got to just leave all the bullshit behind and be the people that each other believed them to be.
Right.
And I think it was nice that you got to see a happy possibly ending for them, because
we won't get endings in comics.
Oh no,
right?
Never.
That's
never
the key. It just has to keep going. So even like you see something like in Superman or Spider-Man or any of these characters, like it's a constant cycle of like the Gambit and Rogue miniseries that Kelly Thompson wrote was so wonderful. Like, I freaking love Gambit and Rogue together. They're one of my one of my favorite pairings. But it was like, I know it's going to end. I know that happiness is going to end. I know it's short-lived.
But doesn't that say so much about life?
I feel like we did it. I feel like we cracked the code.
There we go. Comics are life. And that's it. There was one other thing I was going to say about that, and I don't remember, and it's not important, so who cares?
We did it. Let's wrap.
So with that, thank you for listening. And as always, Leave us some love on iTunes because it helps support and promote the show. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Sci-Fi Fangirls Pod. I am the Sharoness on Twitter and Instagram.
And I am at Runwit Skizzers.
And until next time,
speak deep like a girl.